Little Lake Grange. There'll be an optional performance of the workshop songs with Emmendal Chorale at their Saturday anniversary concert. Force of Nature, Song and Dance Splash features 108 of Neer and Arnold's School of Performing Arts and Cultural Education's dance and a cappella singing students for two performances on Friday at 7 p.m. and Saturday 2 p.m. at the Space Theater in Ukiah. This is Bike to Work Week, culminating with a bicycle fashion show on Friday from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. on Church Street in Ukiah. River Oak Charter School presents Pastels on the Plaza on Saturday from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. This annual community event transforms Alex Thomas Plaza in Ukiah into a gallery of pastel drawings created by local artists. And the 12th Annual Festival of New Plays by local playwrights comes to Mendocino College's Little Theater on Friday and Saturday at 8 p.m. Please submit your public service announcement at least 2 weeks in advance and check out our complete events calendar at kzyx.org.
Good evening. You are tuned to KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits in Ukiah, 88.1 FM Fort Bragg, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, listener-supported community radio. We also stream on the web at kzyx.org. Good evening and welcome to this edition of the Ecology Hour. I'm your host, Doug Mosel, bringing you my monthly episode of the Ecology Hour that I've dubbed the Agriculture and Ecology Hour for reason of the topics I attempt to cover. This evening, I am happy to tell you that I'm going to be talking with Liz Carlisle. Liz is a fellow at the Center for Diversified Farming Systems at the University of California, Berkeley, about which I will be sure to ask her later. She has a PhD in geography, also from Berkeley, and a BA from Harvard University, considerable academic credentials. She's a native of Missoula, Montana, a former legislative aide to U.S. Senator John Tester. Most importantly, not to diminish any of those others, Liz, but most importantly, you are the author of one of my now favorite ever books, Lentil Underground, Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America. And it's about that book, your experience of it, your journey to writing it, that I wish to speak with you this evening, having last month talked with the fellow I consider the star of the book, if you will, David Oyen of Timeless Seeds. So Liz Carlisle, I forgot to say, former country singer, welcome.
Thanks, Doug. It's a pleasure.
You are now perhaps as much as when you were singing country, very well-traveled, having been on this remarkable countrywide tour with David Oyen and others on the topic of the Lentil Underground. Where you're back, though, in the Bay Area right now, soon, I think, to be having another appearance with David later this month, am I right?
Yeah, and David won't make the one later this month. We needed to give him a break, although that's actually not quite true. He's just back to farming and managing his business.
Actually getting some time in to farm, huh?
Yeah. We had to release the book in the winter so that everybody would have a chance to have these conversations, and then once they started seeding, you know, it's I got to go solo for a little while.
Well, shoot. I told him when I talked with him that I would try to make my way to Berkeley and interrupt my farming for a day to get down and actually meet him face-to-face, having known him by email and telephone and now radio for, I don't know, 5 years or so. Liz, I said a little bit about your bio. Let's just start a little bit by talking about your current role as a fellow at the Center for Diversified Farming Systems. Just as a way of a little background and perhaps of interest to some of our listeners, certainly to me, if no one else, what does the center do? What's it up to? I'm kind of surprised to hear that Berkeley has one.
Yeah. Well, you know, this began as really a graduate student affinity group when I was early in my graduate studies at Berkeley. It existed when I showed up there about 6 years ago, and there was a listserv, and it was graduate students who are interested in agroecological farming and what this meant for the food system. So there were graduate students from public health, graduate students in environmental sciences, graduate students in geography who are interested in some of the economic implications of diversification. And we would just get together once a week and have lunch and talk about our research. And then every once in a while we would read a paper by somebody or bring in a speaker. And we saw that we needed to continue to formalize this to make it possible for other graduate students to actually do this kind of research for their thesis and have access to faculty from different departments and start to get the faculty engaged too. So over time, it's become a more and more institutionalized effort, and it's now part of what's called the Berkeley Food Institute, which is supported with an executive director and a couple full-time staff. And that's been very, very exciting. They're giving seed grants to groups of faculty and community partners to explore food systems questions, and they're engaged. They have a full-time policy staffer who's helping faculty who are doing research on diversified farming systems and the food system more broadly to have an impact with that research both in Sacramento and in D.C. So for me, it's been wonderful because this is kind of an organic development, if you will, of just the group of people that I wanted to talk to because I felt like we were kindred spirits. And, you know, now it's got a website, and it can be on my business card.
Well, not to drop names, but I know Anthrop, and we have received, as one of their sort of mini-grants, millet seed to do some test plots up here in Mendocino County. So that is a little bit of a connect the dots with the food institute.
Proof positive that they're doing important work. They know you.
And practical work. I wouldn't say it's important that they know me, but the work I would say is important. Yes.
Yeah. When I showed up at Berkeley, we weren't as connected, I think, to the community partners. There was so much interest in the food system in Berkeley as a community, and those connections between the academic researchers and people farming and involved in the NGO sector were not as strong. And I think that the Berkeley Food Institute has helped to strengthen that, which is a benefit on both sides.
Liz, I, in my eagerness to begin our conversation, I overlooked one of my duties as host. So you will forgive this bit of an interlude as I tell our listeners that support for the Agriculture and Ecology Hour this evening comes from our members and the Solar Living Institute, providing workshops, seminars, and education for sustainable living, renewable energy, and supporting the Real Goods Store and Solar Living Center on Highway 101 in Hopland. Open daily from 10 to 5, Sunday 11 to 4. Information at 472-2403. Support also comes from our members and Mendocino Solar Service, presenting the film Racing to Zero in Pursuit of Zero Waste at the 10th Annual Mendocino Film Festival. Racing to Zero is a quick-moving, upbeat documentary telling the story of San Francisco's race to achieve zero waste by 2020. Screening is Friday, May 29th in Mendocino. Information at mendocinosolar.com and on Facebook. All right, now, Liz Carlisle, are you going to sing a song for us?
I feel like I should sing a song in celebration of the sun now.
Well, yeah, up here you might be singing a song in celebration of some rain that's in the forecast for Thursday. Although the farmer for whom I have 35 acres of hay or so cut may not be real pleased about the timing of that rain. But my spring grain crops will be thrilled. So, Liz, by the way, I will just tell you as a little interlude that I love your singing voice, and I played the only song of yours that I could find on the on YouTube as an interlude when I was talking with David Oyen. I think he was quite pleased.
Good, because he's been telling people he thinks maybe I'm a fraud because he never hears me singing in all these months of traveling together.
Well, what an interesting segue. Because I wanted to start our conversation by your reference to your recognition that after 4 years of touring the country singing country, you knew the sobering truth. You'd been lying.
That's right. Yes. I was telling a romantic story about what it was like to farm and what a beautiful agrarian democracy we had in this country. And I met a lot of farmers who had all of the capacities to realize that ecologically appropriate agrarian democracy, but they were stuck in a system that was not allowing them to do that. They literally couldn't plant the crops that they knew they needed to grow because what was being purchased by the elevator in town, was what the corporation who owned that elevator wanted to purchase, and that corporation dictated the inputs that needed to go on it and such, you know the story. But I did not at that time,
uh-huh.
And it came as a great shock to me. And I realized, hey, these big food corporations are the same people who are sponsoring these shows that I'm doing as a country singer.
Uh-huh.
And they have every interest in me telling this story about who we all are, and it's a lie. You know, it is possible for us to have this ecologically appropriate agrarian democracy, but I'm not going to get there by working with Budweiser and Coca-Cola. So I need to be working with someone else here. And the somebody else, the first job I took after I left country music, was working for Senator John Tester, an organic farmer from Montana, who had seen this same, hypocritical problem and had gotten out of the commodity trap. And I saw him as a mentor and went to work in that office to try to do something about the policies that force farmers into this commodity trap.
How did that connection happen, Liz?
Well, I'm from Montana.
Right.
And so I was coming to this realization around 2007, early 2008, that I was burning fossil fuel and I was kind of on the wrong side of the game here, so to speak. And I was hearing a lot about John Tester because he won election to office in 2006, and it was a major national news story because he was the final seat that tipped things in the favor of the Senate Democrats. They had a very slim majority. And it was an even bigger news story in Montana because he beat out a three-term incumbent, Republican incumbent, and it was really a come-from-behind victory for anybody on the Democratic side to win that seat, and really for anybody to win that seat against this very popular incumbent. And it was kind of symbolically, the new agriculture of Montana against the old agriculture, because this guy that he beat out was an auctioneer and was very much in bed with all of the major money players in conventional agriculture. And he was this organic farmer standing up and saying, this is the system that's actually good for Montana's rural economy. And he won in a squeaker. Super charismatic guy, had served on the school board, just really authentic and genuine. And I think for a lot of people gave them hope in the political system again. And I was one of those people. I had never imagined myself going into political work or policy work. I was an artist. I was a musician. But he spoke to what was civic in me, and I wanted to try to be part of that change that he was talking about.
So you made an overture, and they hired you.
They were advertising a job.
Oh, you know, I see.
The timing was right. I went in for an informational interview to his district office in Montana. I was thinking I was going to get a job in Montana. I went home. I had just read Bill McKibben, Deep Economy. And I thought, all right, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go home, and I'm going to get involved in these important issues of sustainable agriculture and local economies. And I knew about John Tester, and I knew the woman who was working in the district office in my hometown had, before that, done a lot of great work with a local nonprofit, just a really well-respected organizer on environmental issues. So I went in to talk to her, and she said, well, it turns out we have a job coming up, and I think you might be a good fit for it. You should throw your hat in the ring. And I got myself totally invested in the idea of what this job would be, because it was all about communicating with people in agriculture and natural resources in Montana and being a liaison between them and the policy team. And then, after I'm already in love with the job, she says, and it's in Washington, D.C. Because I just made this big decision, you know, I'm going off the road, I'm going to go home, I'm going to go to back west. But at that point, I was sold. So I did go to D.C., and I did work there for a little over a year, learned a ton, and, you know, discovered that he was part of a huge group of farmers. He wasn't just this one maverick organic farmer who bucked the commodity system. And it didn't happen overnight. There was a 30-year farmer science movement that engaged a lot of different people in transitioning into making it possible for people to grow ecologically appropriate rotation crops, and specifically legumes, specifically a farming system based on legume fertility and lentils, to substitute for the synthetic fertilizer. So after the time in D.C., I realized really that was a project I wanted to focus on. And the vehicle to do it for the period of time it would take for me to learn anything of substance from this group of people who had such a depth of knowledge was going to be a graduate program and a PhD program.
I'm curious about that conclusion. What made you decide that the route to exploring this 30-year story would require a doctorate? That's not a loaded question. I'm not critical. I'm just kind of curious about your line of thinking.
Yeah. Well, you know, I had a background in a method called ethnography from my undergraduate degree. I didn't study agriculture in my undergraduate work. We didn't even really have much of an environmental studies program at Harvard when I was there.
And they probably certainly don't major in ag there at Harvard.
No. I did go back. David and I went. They have something called the Food Literacy Project now. And we actually taught a cooking class. Their dining services is really on the forefront of education about food systems issues. And they sponsor these cooking classes, which has been their most popular format. So, you know, we told them that we weren't professional chefs, but that we do cook with lentils. That was a riot. But yeah, anyway, when I was there, I wasn't terribly aware of, you know, agriculture other than what I'd heard from my grandmother, who was a farmer. And what that got me interested in was this stuff about agrarian democracy and sort of the philosophy associated with being a nation of small farmers. So I was doing work in American music that was really about agrarian issues, and I was doing ethnography. So I had learned this method of, you know, immersion learning with a community of people. And I had a sense of how valuable that was. And that's something that is difficult to do outside of the context of an academic program with a social science component. It's not something that people often have the time to do in depth if they're starting a business or if they're engaged in an advocacy effort or if they're running for public office. A lot of the things in our world force us to do things on fairly short cycles. You got to have a deliverable soon. And I just knew, you know, and that was part of the problem of trying to do this work from the Senate office, was that there wasn't enough time to engage in a really in-depth conversation about the history of the movement or why you do this rotation rather than that rotation. So I had the sense that in a PhD program with a full 6 years, that would give me the time to develop some expertise that might actually be useful and at least enough background so that I could be an educated interlocutor with this group of people who had all of this expertise from ecology to policy to, you know, a small business, and that I would have the time to really understand not only what they were doing on their farms, but the social organizing component of it too, and try to understand it well enough to transmit some of that story to other people.
And I want to get to that story, but thank you for that very helpful explanation. The element that I would, well, I think there are multiple elements here in this, what I consider to be a pretty darned inspired piece of work. I'm struck by your gift for writing. And I'm wondering, has that just been a natural part of you, or did you hone your very fine ability to weave a readable, informative, inspiring story while you were in graduate school?
Well, I appreciate that, Doug. Thank you for that compliment. And I started writing very, very young. My mother's first career was as an English teacher.
Uh-huh.
Both she and my dad read a whole lot, and they read a lot to me. And she was always willing to help me with any piece of writing I was doing for school. She would take the time to, you know, not just sort of like correct grammatical mistakes, but, you know, talk about word choice and sentence structure and why one thing might work better than another. And I really wanted to go out of state for college. I wanted to experience something new. And we didn't have a lot of money. And I knew that it was possible to apply for scholarships and that there were a lot of national essay contests that had as a prize a college scholarship.
Aha.
So as it turns out, in my junior and senior year of high school, I wrote about 95 essays.
Wow.
And my mother helped me with every one of them.
Huh.
You know, we went through, she's a great editor, essentially. She was really my first editor. So I did a lot of work on my writing through that process, and I enjoyed it. I really enjoy the craft of narrative. I always have, and certainly that had a lot to do with my becoming a country singer, being a singer-songwriter. I certainly worked with it in college. It was part of a lot of the jobs I did. I wrote press copy for a record company for a while, so sort of telling the stories of the artists and of their work, and it was part of what I was doing for John Tester, too. A lot of writing and a lot of trying to use narrative to take things that can be arcane, like how the Senate makes policy, and tell the story.
Uh-huh.
And I did choose advisors to work with in graduate school who had those talents. Both my advisors on the academic side had those gifts. My major professor wrote a beautiful book for a general audience. It's called Working Wilderness, about a group of ranchers on the Malpai borderlands, New Mexico, Arizona, Mexico borderlands, who came together with agencies to talk about how to return fire to the landscape.
Huh.
So they were great writers. And then I also took courses at the journalism school with Michael Pollan and with a National Geographic writer who's also from Montana, actually, named Edwin Dobb. And the focus of that work was very much on narrative and narrative structure.
Well, it shows. I don't truthfully have a lot of patience for reading. I rarely read a book from cover to cover. And the first thing I have to tell you is that although I knew of this book, I went to visit Timeless Seeds back in February when I went out there to look at some grain cleaning equipment. And on the table when I walked in was a copy of The Lentil Underground. And I immediately turned to Heather and said, I have to take this copy with me. So I paid for it and took it along. I started reading it when I got home and read it, you know, not nonstop, but read it daily, basically, until I was finished with it. And so it's a real testimony, not just to the inspired story of the farmers. But the way in which, as you put it, you crafted it, it was beautifully done. I really appreciate people who can use the language well without pretense, and that is what I think drew me right in. So thank you for that. So you went in search of David Oyen. How did you first hear about him? Was it while you were with Tester?
It was, yeah. While I was with the Tester office, I pretty quickly realized that the way people made it possible to do organic farming in Montana was they were growing leguminous crops, and particularly lentils. Lentils were this keystone of making it all work ecologically as well as economically. They were the biological fertilizer, and they were the high-value rotation crop. So, you know, this even came up in John's campaign and was kind of a funny thing. This flat-top guy from eastern Montana who's growing lentils, of all things.
So it actually did come up in the campaign.
It absolutely did, yeah. And he'll say, and he will to this day, you know, lentils is what paid off my house, which he always gets a big laugh. Since probably most of your listeners aren't from Montana, there's a cultural divide between eastern and western Montana. And eastern Montana is kind of where there's more Republicans, and it's seen as more traditional, and a lot of stereotypes that don't turn out to be uniform. But western Montana has both of the colleges, and that's where you think you're going to find lentils, essentially, in a lentil soup at a vegetarian restaurant. So, John was crossing cultures. So I had been hearing about lentils, and then what I kept hearing from farmers when they would call into the office, you know, who taught you about lentils? Where did you learn about lentils? Oh, I saw them up at David Oyen's place. Or, you know, my friend who lives down the road, he went to one of the Timeless Seeds field days, and that's who taught him about inoculant, or, you know, gave him his first bag. So it was kind of like this tracing back to a point of origin. It was a group movement, but there was clearly a person at the heart of it who had very, very passionately advanced this different way of farming. And it just became clear that if I wanted to get to the bottom of this story, I obviously needed to meet this person.
So you went to his farm. You made an appointment. You went to his farm. You're having this sort of matter-of-fact. It almost sounded, from the way you wrote it, pretty unemotional kind of conversation. And the number four comes up.
Yes. So in Montana, license plates are numbered according to the size of cities at the date when they established this.
Yeah.
So it's now changed. But Missoula was the fourth biggest city at that time, and that's where I'm from. And that is where, and I had borrowed my parents' car for my research. I didn't have a big fancy grant for this. And that is where David had studied in graduate school. And one of the most influential people for him had been this religious studies scholar, Joseph Brown, who worked with Native Americans. And so, you know, David had made this connection. He saw this four on my license plate and remembered that experience and asked me if I knew him. And that, you know, really struck a chord with me because I had known that David studied with him. And the parallel, basically, is that I was 27 at the time I went to go meet David. David was 27 at the time he came back to that farm when he made this big transition in his life. Joseph Brown was 27 when he went to go talk to a Lakota elder named Black Elk. And so I felt like there was this parallel of, you know, like David Oyen was my Black Elk in a way. I was seeking out this mentor who was going to really change the way I thought about the world.
Well, I almost made it. The clock right now says 27:57, and I'm from 26 County in Nebraska. So I love the way these things happen. But one of the reasons I brought that up is because when he looked at your at the license plate on your car, the expression on his face changed and the tone of your conversation changed. That's when he said, come on inside and bring your notebook.
Yeah. So I think there was a moment, many moments in this research with different people where You know, I came to research something agronomic and ecological, really. I was a graduate student, and I had been in a PhD program at that point for 3 years. So I had gained a certain level of formality in how I talked about these things, and that also felt respectful. So most of the questions that I started with in an interview were about what's in your rotation, what inputs do you use, almost like an organic inspection, kind of a friendlier version of an organic inspection, you know, because I wasn't verifying anything, but I was interested in the system. But of course, for me, as for people farming, this is deeply personal.
Yeah.
You know, people have changed their whole lives because they really believe this is a better way of doing things. And, you know, I changed my whole life because I believe this was a better focus for my time and energy. And those realities came together in our interaction with one another at moments. And we realized we can speak to each other on this level, too, about why this is so meaningful to us. And so when those conversations took that direction is when I started to learn from people really about their agrarian wisdom, coming full circle to what I was trying to find as a country singer about, you know, what is the heart of this Jeffersonian agrarian democracy that we would like to see, that is sort of the best of the dream of this country. And people had amazing reflections about how they saw themselves coming closer to that kind of a paradigm through their work as organic farmers.
Ladies and gentlemen listening, the bright, articulate voice you are hearing talking with me is Liz Carlisle, author of Lentil Underground. Had you decided at this point that you were going to write a book?
I had not. The framework I used for my research was participatory action research.
Ah, yes.
So, yeah, so my idea was basically, I know these are the people that I need to learn with and from, and that what they're doing is something that I support. So I'm going to go there, learn what I can learn, and figure out what it is that I can do as an output of my research that will be of use, you know, and will recognize the time and effort that people have put into helping me with my research. That's kind of a full circle type of a perspective on how research with a community should work. So it was iterative, basically, trying to figure out what I could do to be of support and, you know, sort of what was falling out of this research. And I had these narrative skills as a former country singer and as somebody who'd been engaged in writing. And people were so eloquent in the way they spoke about what they did. They were characters, so my sort of narrative brain was engaged. It was like lighting up in that part of my brain. Oh, my goodness, this person is such a great spokesperson. And I had already worked with Michael Pollan a little bit at that time, and I really saw the need for a narrative about people from a place like this, because there are so many about, you know, the California organic movement or a New England organic movement. And there's not a whole lot about organic farmers in the middle of the country who are in such a different situation economically, culturally, and in terms of the type of land they're farming. So I felt that, you know, it could, of course, be of service to this movement to have their work highlighted. But I also felt it would be of service to the food movement more broadly as we think about the diverse pieces of changing the food system. And we got to do it in the middle of the country in addition to on the coast.
So, in our remaining 26 minutes, would you draw a few, as you put it at the end of the book, nuggets from the many stories you tell so eloquently in the book? What are some treasured stories that you might relate to us briefly? Before I'll tell you ahead of time, we talk a little bit about where all this might be going.
Sure.
I want to get to that question.
Yes, that's an important question. I'll tell you about a farmer named Jerry Habits, who is from the same community as David. He's from Conrad, Montana. And he's known David all his life. He's a little bit younger than David. So when David came back to his family farm, when he was 27, 1976, and converted it to organic, Jerry was 19, and he was very much a conventional farmer, committed to the conventional farming mindset, and he drives by this place, and it's weeds to
right.
him. You know, he sees the difference, and he sees, oh, man, that farm is going downhill fast. And, you know, of course, David came home with cultural baggage as well. Some of the things he was talking about in terms of his perspective on the world, he'd gotten engaged with the anti-war movement, he'd gotten engaged with the ecology movement, his hair was long. You know, so Jerry just saw this weirdo.
Yeah.
He'd come back to this farming community and figured, you know, that farm's probably going to go bankrupt pretty soon. Well, fast forward to the millennium, the turn of the millennium, and things have gone well for David, and Timeless Seeds is now going strong as a business, and he's working with natural food stores all over the country, and there's a number of farmers growing for it, and they've got their processing plant up and running. And it's actually Jerry's farm that's having trouble. So Jerry was at this moment, he'd just gotten divorced, he went bankrupt, actually, and was trying to get the farm back on solid ground. And so I tell the story in the book, you know, first he tried the Bible, then he went to a psychic, and then he went organic, which was the, you know, kind of like the last ditch, desperate thing to do. But he walked in the door of Timeless Seeds and just said to David Oyen, you know, look, clearly the system that we're in isn't working. It hasn't been working for me. And I want to try to convert this place. You know, I can't afford chemicals or fertilizers anymore because I'm bankrupt. So I need to farm without them. And I need your help to figure out how to do that. And, you know, you buy the kind of crops that I think I need to grow to do it. And he's been working with Timeless Seeds ever since. He's actually leasing a part of David's ground right now because David's been so busy at the plant. He hasn't had time to farm all his ground. So he's this incredible success story and somebody who came to organic farming because he saw through his experience why it was necessary to leave the chemical system and the commodity system, and has become such an eloquent spokesperson. He's just so observant. He notices that there's more bees on his place. He's really learned to read a lot of signals from his environment to figure out when to plant. You know, he watches the trees and when they green up. He's just developed all of these powers of observation that were not part of farming conventionally because it was so plug and play. And he says he loves farming more than he ever has because it's an adequate challenge to his brain. He's really a pretty intellectual guy. And among the problems with conventional farming for him, in addition to the going bankrupt, was that it just wasn't interesting enough. And now working with complex systems and really being engaged as a naturalist and an ecologist, he's in his, you know, he's just totally found his calling, really, which is actual farming, you know, not just plug-and-play farming.
Was he the one, if I'm recalling correctly, who took you on this kind of wild ride on the four-wheelers around his place?
That was a neighbor of his.
Oh, that was the neighbor. Okay.
Tuna McAlpine. Yeah. He's another great story.
There were moments when I could almost picture these farmers based on your descriptions of them and certainly could imagine fascinating conversations with them. Did any other of these farmers besides David show up on the tour?
Yes. Yeah, actually 25 people came from Montana for the first week of February in the Bay Area for the kickoff events. It was amazing.
I'm so sorry I missed that.
Yes. It was an incredible week. You know, it was incredible for them because they do a lot of great work anytime they're all in the same place, which is not often because, as you know, Montana geography, you know, they're far apart from each other.
Right.
So they get together generally, you know, a couple, three times a year at this annual barbecue that Timeless has, and then they'll usually have a winter meeting too. But we got them all in the same rental house in El Cerrito, you know, which could have been a reality show.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Wow. Talk about a fertilizing moment. A nutrient-rich moment. Yeah, well, so I want to, before we jump into a couple of these big, big issues, talk about, I mean, you've been all over the country almost, I think, in the last couple of 3 months. What are some highlight reactions and responses from people who have shown up?
You know, there's just been so many great elements of this Lentil Underground tour, which was really envisioned as using a book as a vehicle for community organizing. And I think one of my favorite parts has been the engagement with students. We were in a lot of classes and we were at a lot of campuses, and I think it was really encouraging for Dave to hear what the next generation is thinking, and inspiring for them, as it has been for me, to have this elder in the room. Who's tried a lot of these things and has really some insight. But one story I'll share is we had lunch with a graduate club for sustainable agriculture at North Carolina State University, fairly traditional land grant, at least until pretty recently. And they're struggling in North Carolina with the bottom dropping out of the tobacco economy, which has made room for a conversation about sustainable agriculture and local food systems, people who want to stay on that land but aren't going to be growing tobacco anymore.
There's a strong local grain movement in North Carolina.
There is, yeah. Yeah, and actually a Center for Environmental Farming Systems that got started in the mid-90s, really one of the earliest programs in sustainable agriculture. Anyway, so there's this group of graduate students, and they all know each other really well, and we go around the table and we learn about what each of them is working on, and they're from such different disciplines, and they all see their work as part of changing the food system. So there's this woman who's a postdoc in animal science, and she's studying alternatives to antibiotics for treating common disease problems in livestock. She's working with herbal treatments, thyme, garlic, and oregano, basically. You know, and then next to her is this guy who's a community development specialist, and he's interested in farm-to-institution programs with low-income childcare facilities. And then there's this woman doing participatory research with small farmers in Central America dealing with soil health. And, you know, we go around the table like this, and there's about 10 of these incredibly bright graduate students who are each tackling a piece of rebuilding a food system that's healthier and more just and more environmentally sustainable in the middle of this relatively traditional land-grant university. And it was just so inspiring.
So what's the big change in your own life as a result of this journey?
Oh, gosh. I don't even think I have absorbed that yet, you know? It's still, I feel like I'm still integrating everything that I have learned, not just through the research, but I learned probably more, honestly, directly in terms of questions and interview with David Oyen over the course of having all these conversations with different people all over the country and hearing him answer other people's questions. It was like a whole nother research project.
I bet.
To hear all of that.
Yeah.
Questions that I never would have thought of, that other people came up with, and then hearing his answers to those. So I think it's fundamentally changed the way I look at the world, a process that I intended to initiate, certainly, by seeking out this group of people. But this will always be foundational to who I am. It's a long project and a really deep project to have done at this time in my life. And I couldn't be prouder, really. I mean, it's the foundation of my career. Anybody's dissertation pretty much is, if they're going into teaching. And to have done that critical training work for myself in partnership with this group of people, I just couldn't be more honored.
And indeed, proud of your work. So I, before we talk about the big issues that I want to get into in the last 15 minutes with you, have you thought about writing any new songs now?
You know, somebody beat me to it. Do you know about the Food Corps? It's
no,
AmeriCorps for the food system.
I don't think so.
It's fantastic. It actually started in Montana. It's now around the country. There's some great Food Corps projects in California. But these are AmeriCorps people who are working on food systems issues. Mostly they're doing a lot of farm to school.
Oh, okay.
I think
yeah, we have some of them up here. I just didn't know they called it Food Corps. Okay.
Yeah.
AmeriCorps.
Well, there's one of them who was stationed in Ronan, Montana, and she wrote the lentil song.
Uh-huh.
As part of a curriculum for second graders to learn about the food system and sustainable agriculture. And she put it on YouTube.
Oh, I'll look it up.
So I linked to it on the Lentil Underground website.
Okay.
She's doing the hand motions and everything. It is amazing.
Sounds fun.
Nikki Jimenez, the lentil song.
The lentil song. Now, you didn't answer my question, though, Liz. That was gracious of you that someone beat you to it. But are you thinking of writing any new country songs?
Well, you know, as my partner says, I think the Lentil Underground is my long-form country song.
Yes. 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 Okay. All right. I'll quit pressing on that. So the subtitle... if you will, of your book, Lentil Underground, which, by the way, for those of you who might be intrigued about the book and where to get it, is published by Gotham. Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America. So what do you see as the future of food in America when you... when you compare against the background of your experience over these last years in talking with these inspired farmers, wise, ecological farmers, how do you project a future of this sort of local regional movement versus big food? Versus the impending, the disasters. I'll just offer my own opinion. The disasters of the free trade agreements and the behemoth of them, the Trans-Pacific trade agreement coming up, that have such an enormous bias toward big food. How do you see the future of it?
Yeah, it's a lot of challenges. A little bit of good news this afternoon. The Senate actually blocked the fast-tracking.
They did. Thank you for that. Newsflash.
Yes, yeah.
No kidding.
Checked my email right before we spoke, and Maiwa Montenegro sent the news out to the Diversified Farming Listserv. She's so good about keeping us all informed.
They actually blocked fast-track.
They did.
Bless their political hearts.
I know. Yeah, there's some sanity. There's still some sanity around here.
Oh, all right. Well, that's the best thing I've heard all day.
Yeah. Well, it's not to say that it's not still on the horizon and that we haven't been moving in this direction for a long time. You know, NAFTA was, what, 1994?
Yep. When you were a youngster.
I know. I was 10 years old and I had
Did you
no
even
idea.
Know about NAFTA?
I did.
Did you?
There were political cartoons in the Missoulian.
Uh-huh.
I can't say I had any idea what its significance was. But yeah, I mean, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I hope that this is not just, you know, sort of a short-term blocking, but that in fact it initiates the long and deep conversation about why this is a bad idea, not just for us here in the United States, but for people around the world.
Well, of course.
And, you know, as for that title, that subtitle about the future of food in America, of course, I'm trying to use the power of suggestion a little bit.
Sure.
But I'm also aware that what I love about this group of farmers is that they're trying to farm within the constraints that a lot of the rest of us are still not paying attention to. Fossil fuel, water, you know, they're thinking about these things as limited resources. And our food system still mostly operates as though those were unlimited resources. Certainly in California with water, you know, and that is beginning to come home to roost. So a lot of the strategies that people have developed to try to be more water wise and more fossil fuel wise, we're going to have to utilize those strategies. We're just going to have to, because climate change is here in a really real way, and water scarcity is here. So that's why I think, you know, this is the future of food, is that the constraints that are evident to people are shifting. And then I think it becomes a question of what are our values and who do we care about? And as we move into a world of different constraints, are we really going to ensure food security for everybody? Or is there going to be a privatized water system, for example, that continues to allow certain people to live as though water were more or less unlimited, but other people get the shaft?
Yeah. I don't have a follow-up to that. I will confess to you that I am pessimistic about the large scale on which we've been operating, as you say, on the assumption that we have endless resources, that chemical fertilizers will always win the day because we can control things that way. You know, where I grew up on a dry farm back in Nebraska that was, I mean, we had native grass, hay meadows. And when our farm was sold, two of the quarter sections of land, which included those beautiful native grass prairies, were immediately plowed under and a pivot well sunk in the middle of each. If you look at an aerial photo of my home county, number 26, Antelope, right up to the borders of our little hometown, it's pivot well circles, as though the Niobrara aquifer will never be depleted. You know, here in California, as though the snows in the mountains will abide forever, filling the reservoirs, allowing us to pipe water into areas where farming shouldn't actually happen. So, sorry, I'm preaching now a little bit. but I have great hope in the stories of people being able to do it locally, and it seems to me that the Montana farmers have found sort of a middle ground, because they're certainly not only selling direct and locally, they're selling nationally and even internationally, but not exactly participating in what I'd call the commodity market. Talk a little bit about that tension and how that's impacted by trade practices.
Yeah. I mean, they're doing relationship-based marketing at multiple scales, as you mentioned. So about 5% of what Timeless Seeds sells is in Montana. Pretty small, because there's only 1 million people in Montana. Then 85% would be domestic, and then another 10% is exported, mostly to Canada and a couple buyers in Asia. But all of these are what I would call a values-based supply chain, which is to say that the buyer is interested in the same values as the producer. So it's not just a homogenous commodity, you know, pay so much for this many bushels of that. There's an understanding that it's a partnership over the long term, and the end consumer is interested in this too. You know, the statistics say that most of the end consumers interested in organics, probably their first concern is nutrition, but then also environmental sustainability. So the markets that Timeless Seeds has pursued are with people who understand that the food system is a partnership between all of its elements and not just, you know, a faceless commodity that you purchase for the cheapest possible price. So they work mostly with regional distributors that in turn work with natural food stores, mostly independent ones. So they're not with a big national distributor, and they're not doing most of their business with a big national retailer. They work a little bit with Whole Foods in particular areas, but they're not doing that through corporate. They're doing that through individual regions. And so all of that is a different strategy that certainly gives them more resilience and diversity in their own markets, but also is just connecting them with a different kind of consumer base, you know, who are her partners in trying to transform the food system to be more holistic in the way it thinks about the value of food and agriculture as something with multiple potential benefits, ecosystem services, nutrition, rural economies.
You haven't used the term, but as I listened to your last comment, it strikes me that a feature of this relational marketing and distribution is that there's a fair piece of the anonymity removed.
Exactly, yes, because hopefully we have moral guidance in how we treat other humans. You know, when there is a face on some kind of business dealing, a set of values are part of that. You know, we acknowledge the golden rule, you know, that we wish to treat others as we would want to be treated ourselves. And we see a farming family and we see everything that they're doing to take care of their land and the fact that they need to pay their kids' college tuition and all of these things, as opposed to just seeing what's the lowest possible price I can pay for this product. And I don't blame people for thinking that way in a lot of cases, because you know, the larger question that needs to be solved here is the whole macroeconomy that forces so many people,
right.
So many people in these really, really low-wage jobs,
yeah.
You know, often working multiple part-time jobs. And the cheap food economy arose in the 80s at the same time that we went to a lower-wage workforce,
yeah.
You know, and there was a lot of union busting at that time, and those two things were born together, and somewhat intentionally. So we need to change those things as a piece, you know, to empower people to be food citizens and not be in abject poverty, basically.
And one of the tensions here is that often these value-based products, food products, are more expensive than the cheap food products that have become so prominent in the consumer economy, and what you describe as the sort of macroeconomic pressure on the consumer exists as well, as you said at the beginning of our conversation, on the farmer.
Right.
So both are locked into this unfortunate system. Whereas one wheat farmer I interviewed years ago on this show said, you know, we're not really farmers, we're managers. We're locked into a system where all we do is follow a step-by-step routine that's basically dictated by the larger system.
Yes, and that larger system has not been forced to internalize its costs, so that
no.
Cheap food is artificially cheap because it's subsidized, and also because it's not forced to pay for the cost of all of its environmental externalities,
yeah.
As well as its nutritional externalities. So it's really cheap, you know, to go out and buy that soda, you know, and for some people that's the cheapest calories they can get, and,
yep.
You know, they're on a low wage, whatever. But, you know, who's paying the cost of the treatment of the diet-related diseases, and who's paying the cost of the fertilizer that ran off of that cornfield that's been used for the high-fructose corn syrup? who's paying, you know, for the farm labor involved in meat packing, you know, or the processing labor, I should say. You know, that's just a terrible, terrible situation for those laborers. So there's all these costs of the cheap food that the corporations who profit from that cheap food are not being forced to pay. We're all paying for it in one way or the other. So, you know, if